Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
2004 marked the 40th anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act, a bold yet practical act to preserve America's finest wild places. Within these last 3 years, so much has changed on good old planet Earth that wilderness just may be taking on a significance few ever dreamed it would be. For wilderness is about to become the sacred shrines of the garden. In just a moment, we hear what's happening to the wilderness movement in America. Be prepared to be surprised as your voice of the earth goes in depth into the wilderness. Stay tuned. There are so many discussions of so many issues these days that confront us right up front. Global warming, the demise of species, which is astonishing. The discussion, for example, that Ebola is really a serious threat to the gorilla population on this planet. If we lost them, it's hard for me to imagine that we're really involved in witnessing this in our time. So other issues seem to be moving kind of off the radar screen a little bit, but there's a lot of reasons for that. And one of those that I think is really fascinating to take a look at is the topic of wilderness, which, of course, around the 40th anniversary was such a major event. But since then, it's kind of become a little more quiet. That doesn't mean that there isn't plenty going on. And as a matter of fact, part of the good news is that there's a terrific amount of success stories to report. And there's possibly no one better to bring us up to date on that than Michael Matz, who's the executive director of the Campaign for America's Wilderness. Mike, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks, Sydney. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I hear that, first of all, there's some really good news, and that's the fact that you're looking at your fifth anniversary. Why don't you tell us about what that means to you and the people at the Campaign for America's Wilderness?
Sure, it is very exciting. We became the Campaign for America's Wilderness in October of 2002 and really got to roll up our sleeves and sink our teeth into these issues of trying to protect America's public lands for future generations. And I really do think that there's a cause for optimism here, Sydney. We've seen some remarkable progress in the last 5 years where, when we first started out, there was a bill for a wilderness bill for California, Colorado, and Nevada, and that was about it. But since then, over the course of that 5 years, we've been able to get about 74 new wilderness areas designated as part of the National Wilderness Preservation System. That's about 2.4 million acres in those 74 areas, which is about the size of Rhode Island and Delaware combined. So it's a pretty good chunk of land, and it's for the future. It's protected permanently, so this is a gift that we'll give to future generations so that they can use and enjoy it just as we've had the opportunity to do.
And I think there's a lot of people who are really beginning to realize the incredible significance and importance of wilderness as life becomes more complex these days, and the pressures of just trying to figure out the proper path to move forward becomes clouded. There is no better place to restore and find truth than those wilderness experiences. I know you yourself have been involved in getting out to plenty of wilderness areas. What are some of your favorites?
Oh, boy. Sydney, it's really, I think, hard to pick one or two. There are so many really nice ones to be able to get out, whether to go on a raft trip or go hiking or fishing, whatever. There's a plethora of opportunities out there, and it'd be hard to pick really one or two, but I gotta say that growing up, I was really enamored of the Boundary Waters in northern Minnesota. That was the first wilderness area that I ever visited, and so obviously that one has left a certain impression on me.
The Boundary Waters is one that I think embodies one of the purest wilderness experiences, because if you keep on going north, you're pretty much going to end up in the middle of wild, wild country. It is true wilderness. It's a unique experience.
It's nice in that regard because, yes, Quetico, Superior region there, they have a provincial park on the Canadian side, so you can go across the border and into Canada, and it's you know, one seamless wilderness. And I think there are others around the country that are, people are trying to do that. I mean, not only for the recreational opportunities, but also because wildlife really doesn't know any boundaries. And so for in the North Cascades, for instance, I think people are really interested in protecting areas on both sides of the border so that the potential for wolves and grizzly bears to go across the border is seamless. In Arizona right now, there's a great deal of concern because we have legislation that we're supporting in the two macaqueries where there used to be desert jaguars, and there have been some sightings again. But, you know, they're thinking about putting up a border fence there, and that would not only limit people from coming into the country, which I think is the intent, but also some of the wildlife. But at least, you know, on our side of the border there, we would have the habitat protected, and there would be an opportunity for the jaguar to make a comeback.
It sounds like you're optimistic, and that is certainly refreshing to hear from people working in the areas of preserving our lands. Give us a sense of what's leading to this kind of change, because I know it used to be a massive struggle, but I think you're figuring something out. And why don't you share with us what you're finding out?
Sure. We had good success in the last couple of Congresses when they were run by the Republicans. The committees were chaired by Republican members of Congress who weren't necessarily all that supportive of wilderness, but the approach that we take is to work with local partners in each of these states and, you know, get down into the communities and see what people really want for their landscapes, for their communities. And that kind of a ground-up approach has really served us well. It's engendered a lot of support among Republican members of Congress in Idaho, for instance, but elsewhere, Colorado, Oregon. And it was difficult for the leadership then to say no to these particular members of Congress who are from the same party. So we were able to pass bills, you know, even in that climate, using that kind of an approach. And we decided, well, can't argue with success, so we're going to continue to do that, even now as the Democrats have assumed the reins in Washington and have taken leadership positions on the committees with jurisdiction over public lands. This year, you know, where we had one or two or three bills in the first year that we were working on, we have 10 bills that have a viable chance this year of making it, or this Congress, and we may see a couple more added to that list by the end of it. I mean, it's really mushrooming here. It's pretty encouraging to see, and it is because it's driven locally by the county commissioners or the mayors or the chambers of commerce or the local hunting and fishing groups. It's an organic process that's burbling up to the top, and fortunately, public servants in Washington are responding.
Well, that's very exciting, because I think when the wilderness system was first initiated in 1964, 43 years ago, it was much more of a top-down. There were massive areas that were set aside, but then that kind of leveled off, as you said. It's now coming from the grassroots, so it's really changed, and the significance of that is the fact that this is meeting local people's needs and desires and wants. Talk a little bit about the process of organizing and how you work with the local community to achieve this success.
Well, really, what's heartening to see is that, you know, here's a case where we can make democracy work for us. We can actually make the government do the kinds of things that local people want to see, and I think that's real empowering to people. But basically what, you know, folks do in a local area is they know that there's a special spot that they've enjoyed and gone to or visited and want to make sure that it's stays that way for future generations, for their kids to be able to go and do that as well. So they maybe get together a local meeting with some other folks who've visited that area, and then they'll talk to a couple county commissioners or go to their city council and let them know that they're interested in seeing this area protected. And it kind of, you know, snowballs from there. The city council or the county commission gets involved, and then, you know, the realtors decide that this is going to help property values, and so they jump on board. The hunting and fishing groups know that there's members that they have who use those areas, so they jump on board, and it kind of builds itself up like that. And finally, it reaches the member of Congress who says, okay, you guys have developed a lot of local support here. It's not that they're not without some opposition. It's just that the overwhelming majority sentiment seems to be, let's protect this area. And the member of Congress then is enabled to step forward and introduce legislation.
You know, there's a big difference between wilderness areas typically in the West and the East, because there's a lot more open space and open land and public lands in the West than there is in the East. But I'm just curious, if you go into the eastern areas, I'm sure it's a bigger challenge to create wilderness, but what is kind of a minimum size for wilderness? How small a parcel of land can be considered? Is there a minimum?
There isn't really. I mean, if it's adjacent to some protected areas like another wilderness area or a national park, it can be anything. If it's standalone, it usually is about 1,000 acres or more. And in the West, obviously, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of acres that still retain their wilderness character. But even in the East, you know, we've got proposals for Virginia in the western part of the state, the Blue Ridge, that is, I think, about 40,000 acres. There's going to be a proposal introduced sometime here in the next couple of months for West Virginia. And West Virginia is a little bit bigger in size, more areas. There's a legislation introduced right now for Georgia, and we're working on a bill for the Allegheny National Forest in Pennsylvania. Last Congress, too, Sydney, a bill was passed to protect areas in Vermont and New Hampshire. So it's not just a Western thing, but as you note, most of the public lands, especially the big stretches of it, the large swaths of public land, are located in the West.
And, of course, that's where I think one of the reasons that things are changing, we'll talk a little bit about that, the changing demographics of wilderness activism, because I see a change coming. It's happening, as a matter of fact. There's a whole new variety of players that are seeing the importance of wilderness that we hadn't seen so much involved before. But on a more sort of practical, you know, looking at the landscape, in the last 8-10 years, there's been such a tremendous letting of leases for oil and gas, particularly in the West and Utah and Montana, all over the place. And I'm curious to what degree a shock value has occurred and people are beginning to realize, how is that affecting people's desire to really step up and protect their lands?
Oh, it's definitely had an impact, definitely. I mean, in Colorado, for instance, there's this unbelievable place called the Rhone Plateau, kind of in the central west part of the state. It's historically had large numbers of elk and clear trout streams, and so the sporting community up in that area have traditionally gone there. I mean, we're talking about grandfathers taking their sons and then those fathers taking their sons, and you know, it's got a long history of that, and the fact that the Bush administration has just wholesale leased that area, and as you say, other areas across the West, whether in Utah or New Mexico or Wyoming, it's had an impact. It has definitely taken some people aback here, and conservative Republicans have come out in support of protecting these areas, so much so that, you know, the members of Congress who normally would be probably siding with the oil companies on this issue are trying to get the agencies to, slow down here a little bit. Let's take a look at what you're doing and maybe not approach it so aggressively.
In the past, there have been all sorts of real hot-button issues that drove a lot of wilderness discussion. For example, whether or not roads would be allowed in wilderness. Give us an update on kind of what's happening to some of these otherwise, these issues that in the past have raised such issues. Are they particularly like roadless areas? What's the status on that in wilderness now? Because that was so contentious.
Well, the Bush administration, when they came in, they rescinded the policy that the Forest Service had gone through a pretty lengthy public process to promulgate regulations that would have kept roads out of about a third of our national forests. And, you know, obviously roads only go into these places when they want to log them or develop them for oil and gas. And that was a pretty good balance if you think about it, one-third of the national forest being set aside as roadless. But that wasn't enough, unfortunately, for the Bush administration. So they rescinded it. It's been in the courts for the last couple of years. And the last decision was to maintain the policy as it originally was. So that third of the national forest, about 58 million acres, I think, Sydney, is protected. And they can't go in right now and develop it for roads or oil and gas or logging. But
you know, that's why there are these battles, because it was the people who got out there and said, we just cannot allow these changes to happen, and therefore these protections are now maintained. It's so important to become involved.
It is, and that was one other thing I wanted to mention. Saturday, September 29th, is National Public Lands Day, so it's an opportunity for people to show their support for their public lands, whether it's national forests or national parks or lands that are administered by the BLM or the Fish and Wildlife Service. And there are a host of opportunities for service projects to go out and restore trails or, you know, even pick up litter in some of these places. You can get in touch with public lands folks in your region to see what kinds of events they might have Saturday to participate. And if you're looking for something to do with, you know, other people who care about these lands. And then, obviously, too, if it's, as it is with many people, kind of busy, got things to do, soccer practice to go to or whatever, there's always the ability to write a letter to your member of Congress and let them know that you support protection of public lands as wilderness, that this is America's common ground, and it's nice to be able to pass this along to future generations. That may be the easiest thing, but it's not always the most satisfying or rewarding, especially if you can get out on a nice day and help rebuild the trail.
We covered National Public Lands Day last week, and there were literally hundreds and hundreds of activities all over the country. Amazing. And it not just a matter of going out and the wonderful things, cleaning trails and picking up debris on riverbanks and helping to paint bridges and things, but some really exciting field work, even some restoration of historic sites. This is a great opportunity for people to get out. I sense it's going to be a beautiful day, too. It's coming up on the 29th of September. Mike, I'd really like to hear some of the stories of your projects that are ongoing right now, so that if people are listening in particular areas, they can become sensitized to what they can do. I'll go through some states. Why don't I just do that, and you might just give a brief summary of what you're working on.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah. Let's start with Alaska.
In Alaska, the Bureau of Land Management owns a whole heck of a lot of realty up there on our behalf. I mean, we own it, but it administers for it. And right now they're undertaking a process where they're going to formulate land management plans that will be in effect for the next 15 years or so. So we've been working with native communities up there, some of the outlying villages, and letting them know that this process is going on and making sure that they're aware that they have the opportunity to participate in it so that they can make sure that the agency is properly considering their subsistence lifestyles and the need to protect some of these areas so that they can go hunt and fish. I mean, they don't just go to the grocery store like we do, Sydney. They actually live much like their ancestors have done over the millennium. So we want to make sure that these lands are protected for native communities' subsistence opportunities. And that's a process that we're involved in right now in Alaska.
And people can find out details on each one of these by going to www.leaveitwild.org.
That's right. That's our website, and we have each of these campaigns featured in, you know, a little bit more detail than you and I might be able to go into right now.
My effort here is to try to get people in these communities who are listening to learn more.
Get involved, exactly.
There it is. So let's talk about Arizona.
In Arizona, Representative Raul Grijalva, a Hispanic member of Congress from the southern part of the state, has introduced legislation to protect about 70,000 acres of Forest Service land down in the southern part of the state. It's magnificent. I've actually been down there and visited it, hiked up to the top of the mountain. You have some incredibly sweeping views of the surrounding Sonoran Desert. And like I said earlier, it is traditionally habitat for jaguar, and it is coming back into that area. So we'd really like to work with Representative Grijalva to ensure that that habitat is there and protected as the jaguar makes its comeback.
You know, I've been to your website and have visited each one of these write-ups on the various actions that you're working on, and I encourage people to do that, because when you look at the pictures and you see the extraordinary diversity of landforms and the grandeur, it moves me. when I realized just what an incredible planet we live on and how blessed we are here in the United States to have such a diversity. And the end as well, and possibly the greatest thing, the freedom, the democratic right to set these lands aside. We're very fortunate people.
It is. There are, you know, some very special places, a wide variety of them, and the opportunity for us to weigh in and make sure that they're protected as we'd like to see them protected.
How about the Golden State, California?
California, there's a lot going on. In the southern part of the state, Riverside County, there's a member of Congress, a Republican, Representative Mary Bono, who is soon to introduce legislation to protect some areas down there. In the northern part of the state, on the eastern side of the Sierras, there's another Republican member of Congress who is keen on some eastern Sierra areas that we may see legislation introduced. And then statewide, Senator Boxer has introduced a bill that includes these areas and more. And she's indicated a real willingness to reach across the aisle and work with Republicans and Democrats to, you know, incrementally protect as much as in her statewide piece of legislation.
It's very important to show your support for all sides who are involved in these processes. So be sure to write letters and let Mary Bono know that you're with her.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah. Now, Colorado, there's a lot of things happening there. The backbone of wonder in the United States, as far as I'm concerned.
Rocky Mountain National Park. We have a wilderness proposal there for almost all of the national park, which, you know, just means that there's an extra layer of protection and people have the opportunity to go into the backcountry and know that that elk habitat is going to be just the same as it is today. It has been moving through the process, and I think we'll see that legislation enacted before the end of this Congress. And then also the brothers, Senator Salazar and his brother, Representative Salazar, are considering legislation for the central part of the state on the west side, a beautiful area called Dominguez Canyon. The Gunnison River flows by, and I actually visited that this summer. Took my 5-year-old son, and we hiked back to some petroglyphs, some Native American petroglyphs, and it's just, you know, a beautiful opportunity to spend a day in the canyon walking with your son, and then ultimately ending up at a place that has such historical significance. It was wonderful.
It's funny, I go through the list here and I suddenly visit in my mind each one of these states and I have my own personal memories, and that's really one of the great aspects of getting out to wilderness is the fact that it fills you with so much wonder inside your soul. I was thinking about Idaho and Stanley, Idaho and the Sawtooth Mountain Range and a feeling of, wow, timelessness that I have rarely experienced anywhere else. Talk about Idaho.
Idaho is one of those kind of stepchilds. It's not had a wilderness bill for 25 years,
wow,
not since the Frank Church River of No Return wilderness back in the mid-80s. So here's a state that is ripe for action, and thankfully a Republican member of Congress, Representative Mike Simpson, is really championing a proposal for the Boulder White Clouds Mountains in that central part of the state around Stanley that you're talking about. And it made it through the House last Congress. Unfortunately, the Senate didn't quite get to it, but Representative Simpson is as enthusiastic as ever and has been really doing everything that he needs to do to drum up support so that this Congress ultimately approves it. Meanwhile, down in the southwestern part of the state, there's a place called the Owyhee Bruneau Canyonlands, and some committee staff from Washington have gone out there and visited it, and they said, ooh, this is national park quality land. So I think they are interested in pulling together with Senator Mike Crapo a proposal for those canyon lands to protect them as part of the National Wilderness Preservation System. So, you know, here in the next couple of years, we could see some pretty big wilderness bills approved in Idaho for the first time in 25 years.
It's very interesting to hear that, for example, Mike Simpson, a conservative, is behind this. We're hearing more and more of this, and the word conservation is based on conserve. I think what is happening is people are beginning to embrace really true, the deepest and finest values that define America. New Mexico. Wow. I lived there for about 25 years. The land of enchantment. And it is that. It is a unique place. If you haven't been to New Mexico, you must go there. But there are some extraordinary examples of open space and areas that have hardly had any modern involvement with people, but certainly lots of ancient history.
There are two or three proposals right now that the New Mexico delegation is considering, one of which for the Sabinosa has been introduced by Representative Tom Udall, a name that stretches back to his dad, Stuart Udall, who was the Interior Secretary during the Kennedy administration, and then his uncle, Mo Udall, who was the chairman of the Interior Committee back when it did the Alaska Lands Act. So he's carrying on his family's tradition here in protecting wild spaces by introducing legislation to protect the Sabinosa area in northeastern New Mexico. And then down in southern New Mexico, there's a beautiful area down there by Las Cruces. All those open country desert areas that you're talking about. And in Dona Ana County, people are getting together. Here's a case where it's just amazing support. The realtors recently negotiated a compromise package with the conservationists and announced it. And so hopefully we'll see some legislation introduced there in the not-too-distant future, and this Congress has an opportunity to work through it.
Well, New Mexico is a legendary energy state, and it's best that these lands be protected now, and this is one very solid form of protection. And I think people realize that if they don't activate now, they could see those lands dramatically impacted. Oregon, I've lived there too, another state with terrific diversity from the oceans to the desert and everything in between. What's going on in Oregon?
Well, there's a iconic feature in that state, Mount Hood, the volcano, and you can't look anywhere in Portland or anywhere around Oregon without seeing it. And the senators there have gotten together and introduced legislation to protect some areas around the base of Mount Hood, and that actually has moved through committee and is awaiting floor action on the Senate side. So I feel pretty confident that that one will get enacted yet this Congress. And then just 2 weeks ago, Representative DeFazio introduced a proposal that's really been pushed quite forcefully by sportsmen, fishermen, and hunters. Trout Unlimited, for instance, is backing this one seriously. The Copper Salmon area, and it is a beautiful spot with some incredible trout streams that are just magnets for fly fishermen. And so, they've worked with their member of Congress and the local communities and come up with this proposal that enjoys a great deal of support. So I feel pretty good about that one being enacted eventually here, too.
That area around Mount Hood is almost, it's associated with Portland so directly. There's terrific amount of use by the local and expanded community there. So to set aside wilderness areas is a unique and wonderful addition to the opportunities that people have there.
That's right. We're seeing that in Washington State, too. Seattle has a place that's not but 45 minutes, an hour away in the wild Skyhomish Mountains. So there's a proposal for wild sky, and it has passed the House and is awaiting floor action on the Senate side. Mm. So that one may well be introduced. And then there are a couple of other proposals, one for Alpine Lakes and one for the Colville National Forest, that are being considered right now. So we could see three in the state of Washington yet this Congress.
There's a lot of open space in Washington State. Now's the time to act, to set it aside. Utah, there's areas of Utah that I think should be bubble wrapped, and just areas in canyonlands and arches and the Grand Escalante, where they're so fragile and yet so astonishingly beautiful that there's a real challenge to keep them vital and keep the beauty alive. Talk about what you're working on there.
It's interesting that you say that, bubble wrap it for the future. In the 1930s, Harold Ickes was the Interior Secretary for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he advised the president that all of southern Utah ought to be made a national park. Mm. And then obviously in the 60s, 70s, we did get some national parks, but not all of southern Utah. So there's a lot of Bureau of Land Management land there, a lot of which is succumbing to oil and gas development because of this aggressive push by the agencies. And then the other huge threat is off-road vehicles. They've just really started to muck up the landscape down there, which is pretty fragile, as you know. I mean, it's a lot of sand and desert vegetation, so they can have a pretty serious impact pretty quickly. So, yeah, now is the time, I think, for folks in the state and in the delegation to get serious about discussing some of these places and seeing if there isn't room to come to agreement and get some lasting protection from these kinds of threats.
A real quick appeal to the off-roaders, too, in particularly in areas like Utah where the soil has, I believe it's called cryptobiotic. Am I right about that?
That's right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, cryptobiotic, which is this living, little tiny, fragile surface of life that is the basis of life there. And unfortunately, when you run over that with any kind of off-road vehicle, or even put your footprint down, you disrupt it and potentially destroy it. It's really, it's a unique challenge there to protect that the soil layer from being destroyed. Well, how about Virginia?
Virginia.
We're going a little bit east now, and I know you're very busy there.
In Virginia, Representative Rick Boucher and Senator John Warner, who's retiring after the end of this Congress, have introduced in both their respective bodies a piece of legislation to establish some recreation areas so that some of the trails for mountain bikes remain open, and then also set aside some other areas as wilderness so the hikers and horseback riders and fly fishermen can go and not have the kinds of conflicts sometimes that occur when you have too much use by too many different interest groups in these areas. So it's moving along in the House, and I think I saw in some press accounts of Senator Warner's announcement that this is one of his priorities, too, before he leaves Congress. So, you know, keep your fingers crossed, but I think that's another one that we'll see head to the president's desk before the end of this Congress.
Oh, that's fabulous. You know, Michael, you're such a wonderful spokesperson for wilderness values and wilderness action. And you know as much about this as probably anybody does. So when I ask this question, I'm asking someone who can give an informed answer. Where are we in this? What do you see as our needs going into the future? Because we have to really think long range. In terms of wilderness, we better be thinking 50 years out, 25 years out, because we have to start now to be sure that these lands are protected. Where are we in this process? How much more land would you expect that we could set aside realistically?
I think that we've got a lot of life left in these campaigns. That's the beauty of the 1964 Wilderness Act, is it doesn't put any end date on this. As long as there are public lands that still qualify as affected primarily by the forces of nature with our imprint largely unnoticed, that's sort of the definition, then we can designate those areas as wilderness. So it doesn't mean that it has to have been never touched by man. There are areas in West Virginia and Virginia, for instance, that once upon a time, you know, 100 years ago, 75 years ago, were actually logged over, but the forests have returned, and so now we place a different value on them, and we've included them in the National Wilderness Preservation System. The same is true for the Wild Sky area in Washington state. That's an area that has some low elevation forests that 35, 40 years ago were logged over, but now they've come back. And so, you know, the Wilderness Act is not only an opportunity to protect lands that qualify as wilderness, but lands that have been restored. I mean, that's the magical thing about it. I think we can continue to do this so long as the society and our democratic society places an emphasis on setting some of these areas, a representative sampling of these areas aside for future generations so that they have the opportunity to see what we've seen, the views that we've seen, the places that we've visited, you know, and that scientists have the opportunity to study some of these areas and see how they change over time, so how they're affected by forest fires, or how their wildlife populations are responding to global warming. They're wonderful natural laboratories, and And I think it's just stupendous that we have this wonderful tool in the 1964 Wilderness Act.
The next time that you're out and away and you're looking across some particularly impressive and inspiring vista, it may be an appropriate time to ask yourself, is this wilderness or not? And find out. And if it's not, what do you suggest people do if they should have an interest in bringing that land forward for consideration as wilderness?
What we've seen is that people are really good about wanting to maintain the quality of life in the area where they live, especially if they've lived there for any length of time. You know, they want to see the place remain as much as it has over the time that they've been there, and keep the special qualities that attracted them there in the first place, the wide open spaces, the beautiful vistas, the clean water, the clean air. And so, all it takes is talking to a few other people, a local conservation group, dropping by and seeing if there are other folks who are aware of this particular special place, and whether or not there are any threats, or is it recommended by the Agency for Wilderness. And that's really how it starts. It just starts with getting together with a few other people and deciding this area is important enough that I want to write a letter, I want to talk to a city councilor, I'd like to meet with my member of Congress and let him know or her know my interest in seeing this area protected. And kind of mushrooms from there. It just snowballs. One thing adds to another, and pretty soon you've got a wilderness bill that President Bush signs, which he's done in 12 different cases already since he was in there in 2000.
Well, Mike Matz, you've been very much involved in helping bring those lands to that status. Mike is the executive director of the Campaign for America's Wilderness. Mike, one more time, tell people how they can contact you.
They are certainly welcome to go to www.leaveitwild.org, and there's contact information there for folks who can help you get started, can steer you in the right direction, and show you the people in your area to talk to.
And Mike, if you were to encourage people to get out on National Public Lands Day, which is going to be coming up here Saturday, September 29th, what would be the words that you'd use to inspire them to get out?
Oh boy, well, here's a opportunity that we have to give something back to the land that's given us so much. So, it's one day a year, take advantage of it.
Michael, I always absolutely enjoy our conversations, and we're going to do this again soon. Thanks for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Likewise, Sydney. Thanks so much.
In 1855, Chief Seattle shared his vision. We know that the white man does not understand our ways. One portion of the land is the same to him as the next, for he is a stranger who comes in the night and takes from the land whatever he needs. The earth is not his brother, but his enemy. And when he has conquered it, he moves on. He leaves his father's graves, and his children's birthright is forgotten. The sight of your cities pains the eyes of the red man, but perhaps it is because the red man is savage and does not understand. If Chief Seattle is listening, I can say that our blood runs red with his, and that in wilderness his dreams are alive. Following is a quote from the 1964 Wilderness Act. A wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. In Psalms in the Bible it says, where there is no vision, man will perish. And where there is? This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.